I firmly believe that we deserve, period.
I just feel like it's important to keep saying that out loud, that this is us learning in public.
The foundation of I Do Not Have Trash Politics is really just relationships, right?
So if you're not aware of how powerful you are, then how can you be using your power to bring others up?
We're giving you collective liberation. We're giving you personal healing. We're giving you millennial auntie with a mic.
You're listening to Theme, the podcast.
Let's be honest. Grief is a topic that most of us shy away from. Its nebulousness and its association with tragedy, loss, turmoil, and suffering often means we're less inclined to explore its teachings, its offerings, and dare we even say, grief's gifts? In this episode, we were so fortunate to sit down with the iconic Jay Simpson. Jay is a two-spirit Oji-Cree person of the Buffalo Clan with roots in Sipatawayak and Skonan Cree Nation, who often writes about being queer in the child welfare system, as well as being queer and Indigenous. Their work has been performed at the Canadian Festival of Spoken Word in Peterborough and in Guelph with the Vancouver Slam Poetry 2018 team. Simpson's debut book, It Was Never Going to Be Okay, was released with Harbor Publishing in 2020. Jay is co-organizer of the Indigenous Brilliance Reading Series and was named Vancouver Champion of the Women of the World Poetry Slam. Their work has been featured in This Magazine, Prism International, and many other literary journals. Jay resides on the unceded and ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish First Nations peoples, currently and colonially known as Vancouver, BC. With Jay, we got down to discuss the ways that grief has been illuminating, the permission that it can give us, and what witnessing grief does to affirm our pain. Take a listen. Jay, we want to thank you so much for spending a bit of your time with us and talking to us about what is, I would say, not like a casual conversation, like talking about grief and grief in the context of personal transformation and change is like kind of nebulous. So first of all, thank you for your trust in us and for showing up and being so willing to just connect and talk. And I'm deeply grateful for you and also deeply grateful for all of the work that you do to make visible the experience of like two-spirit, Indigenous, Indigiqueer, trans women. I really admire you. I know I'm going to speak for Lala. We really admire you. As well as, I will say this, fashion icon. Like, the way that I've seen, like, your style, especially on Instagram, I'm just like, this is so, I'm loving it. And I'm deeply grateful. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. Oh, such compliments. Yeah, when you approached with this conversation, I was like, oh yeah, this is going to be a really good conversation. And then given the political nature in which we find ourselves, I think it's going to be a devastating one.
Yeah.
On the notion of the climate that we're finding ourselves in, what's happening, not just like politically, but what is materially manifesting in particular for non-binary, gender, non-conforming trans folks, there is so much profound suffering when we are forced to handle grief in isolation, and when we're ashamed that our response to loss or, you know, really fucked up shit is the problem, when actually the loss itself is the problem. And obviously this mirrors a lot of the ways that systemic oppression tells us that our responses to marginalization are the problem, as opposed to like the racism, the colonialism, the transphobia, the homophobia. And I'm wondering about this piece of around isolation, and if you could speak a bit about what having a witness to grief is like, or what being able to witness grief in community, or being able to like have a grief community, having people around, having, you know, the opportunity to, and I don't like to use this word lightly, but like appreciate and like hold sacred what grief in this moment is for you. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think as a preface, one of the things I want to say about grief is that there are so many folks coming to realize or coming to the actualization that we are a society now entrenched in grief with the ways that the society at large is dictating our body and therefore our autonomy. And that is something that many of us have been experiencing for hundreds of years. And it's been very interesting because I have been talking about grief for years, and the way my grief manifests is anger. Like, I am just so angry about so many things. And I always get the feedback that, oh, there's Jay ranting again. Oh, she's starting. Oh, she's got something to say. And now everyone has something to say because things are not going well. And it's one of those situations where it's like, maybe we should be listening to the folks that we think are mad, raving on the streets, who are upset because they are living in this reality that so many folks decided to look away from because it didn't directly impact them. And so with some of these like trans legislations going on in the UK and in the States, and everyone's like being very galvanized, that's in the imperial core. There are laws like this that exist all over the world impacting what folks deem third world countries. And there's no petitions, there's no conversation about getting these trans folks into safety. And that's a layer of racism. But when we look at the colonization of like, you know, North America and South America, it was the trans and two-spirit folks who were killed first because we had the language, we had the culture, we had the teachings, we were the parents, we were the warriors. And so when I am seeing now, there's some level of vindication that I'm feeling because there's more collective grief. But also it's like really frustrating because I've been gaslit for so long. I've been the big bad wolf because Jay's upset about something. And now it's really frustrating because community, I feel like, wants to make a martyr of me to be the voice, to be the person who's had those years processing all of this grief from all of this trauma. So I've done the time. And now folks who are experiencing this grief for the first time, who can't find the language, who can't find the nuance in it and can't form action for it, they're like, okay, let's go to the most traumatized because they've been conditioned to process this grief. But in actuality, we've never been given the space to move through it, to work through it, to like hold it. And I just get frustrated because it is such a human experience, but the amount in which we are being compounded with is exhausting. Like, that cortisol for our society is just not good.
Thank you so much. I'm hearing that for such a long time, it's been grief in isolation. And now it's like this shared collective grief or a recognition that this is a shared struggle. It sounds like for you, that frustrating element is like, how are we taking responsibility for what we, and particularly those of us who see ourselves as like not affected by this tremendous amounts of violence that's being hurled towards trans folks, and particularly trans women, I think are experienced like there's a specific amount of harm. And so I'm hearing you say like, where's the rest of us? Like, how are we doing our work to make sure that we're holding space and creating the scaffolding and like the structures and the validation and the systems that would ensure that like that gaslighting that you've experienced doesn't happen to folks who, you know, maybe look to you and say like, Jay has paved the way for me to feel like I can have this rage or this grief or express this anger, this righteous rage.
I think it's something I've been weighing in my hands is the fact that so much of this hate, so many folks are saying that it's a trans issue, and it is, but very specifically it does impact trans women the most. It's an act of trans misogyny. And I think that's a nuance that needs to be held. And whenever I say it, some folks are like, oh, you're ignoring non-binary folks or other folks. And I'm not, I'm just saying, when we look at this structurally, it has always been about the vilification of trans women and the narrative that trans women are dangerous. And it's been so frustrating because it's so tired. I'm so tired of saying that, like, please see me as a human. Like, I am a human. Fighting for my own humanity just makes me feel even more like a monster. Like, it just makes me feel so unvalued in the community. And for the longest time, especially in Vancouver, I was fighting for so long to just be like, there are people in these spaces who have said terrible things, who are doing terrible things. And I'm the one being removed. I'm the one that's being told that is being aggressive for being so deeply physically uncomfortable and unsafe around these people. So why is their humanity being prioritized when they were the ones who enacted the harm? Mm-hmm. And it's come to the point where there was so much gaslighting in community, and I felt so isolated for such a long time. And then when I became someone who society valued because I published a book and I'm performing, and now I have this like capital exchange that can be given, people are now finally listening. And I think that's so dangerous to the narrative of protecting trans women, because there are so many trans women who lose so much in order to become who they want to be. And accessing the healthcare system in Vancouver is one of the highest violences that we go through. And it's like, you're only going to listen to us if we have platform, if we have something to give you. And it just becomes this bigger issue and this bigger problem. And it's, my gosh, I just feel like I'm like saying the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Something that you just mentioned around, you know, how dehumanizing it is for you to have to demand to be treated as a human with dignity. Oftentimes grief can show us or tell us what matters to us and what we deeply care for as we're grieving something. And I'm curious what, you know, loss, what grief has taught you about what matters to you, what you value, what you need, what you deserve.
I think that's a really hard question, because for the longest time outside of my trans identity as like a youth in care, I grieved a lot. And there was like so much insurmountable grief that I was turning over and over and over and over again. And what it taught me is that sometimes in specific situations, the grief has to be witnessed. The grief has to be seen. Otherwise, it's an act of erasure. And the grief of being like a young Indigenous trans child and having none of the things that I was grieving acknowledged was an affirmation of those acts of colonization onto myself and onto my community. And so I think in part of it, something that made me realize that, like, you know, when we acknowledge grief, it can be a good thing, is the warehouse closed recently and there was a farewell party for it. And there were so many trans folks and we were all crying at the closure of this DIY queer space in a time where it feels like the whole world wants to shut us down. But we had built something so beautiful and so revolutionary together, where instead of like mourning the loss of ourselves, we were surrounded by glitter, crying in each other's arms. And I'm like, this is a space where grief felt good. And where despite everything, we were together, we saw each other, we were speaking the same things and feeling the same things and together. And I think it's so insidious, the nature to feel so alone in our grief, because that is another tactic of colonization, to be made to feel so alone that it's only happening to you. And it's like, you know, we can't unionize in our grief if we don't know and we don't see it and we don't talk about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I appreciate all of the different sort of nuances, the different faces of grief that you're bringing out, the ways grief can look and feel like anger, the way grief can look and feel like dancing together. You know, I'm thinking about the title of your book, It Was Never Going to Be Okay, and just how deeply that resonates as an expression of grief. I'm wondering how you came to that knowing, but also like, what is the difference for you? Like, what was the difference in grieving before you had that knowing versus after having that knowing, and did that knowing of it was never going to be okay, did that make space for different things or for different expressions or different faces of grief for you?
Thank you for that question. I really wanted the title of my book to be called It Was Never Going to Be Okay as like a acknowledgement of my time in foster care, where all of these social workers were telling me that it was going to be okay, especially after grieving so many deaths and so much loss. And they would just say, it's going to be okay. But they never gave me any tangible means of it being okay. They never said like, okay, you just lost a parent. We're just going to make sure that you've got clothes on your back and you've got food in the fridge. Like there was never any of that. There was never any confirmation of the care I needed as a child to experience my grief. And it was the time where like a lot of folks just didn't think children could experience grief and process it. And there was like a lot of like gaslighting where it's like, oh, it was a foster parent that died. They're not your real parent. So you shouldn't actually feel that grief. And I found that the work that I was writing, especially in the first book of poetry, it had to be honest. And a part of that honesty was the fact that a lot of my childhood, I felt like if it was a book, the parts where I was in felt like I had actually been cut out of, and that I was perceiving it instead of experiencing it. And that amount of loss was so large, and it was hard, but I also, there was a lot I took out, but it's just a conversation I don't want to shy away from, because in my culture, when we grieve, we process it, we make the time to hold it. We cut our hair. We scream, and we scream until we can't scream anymore. And that was something I learned by returning to my homelands. And it made me reflect and realize that like as a society and like a Eurocentric norm, we give ourselves the 3 days of bereavement for something or processing something, and that's it. And there's no expression of it. And then it festers and it bottles up and it manifests in different ways. And some of it's, some people deem unhealthy, but I don't like that narrative, because if it's the way we process it, it's the way we process it. And Western wellness culture is gross, but that was a little ramble. But I don't know. I wanted my first book to just be so unapologetically truthful.
I was reading this book, one of Adrienne Marie Brown's book on, it's called Holding Change. And she has a bunch of different poets and writers that contribute. And one of them is Malkia Devitch-Cyril. And Malkia writes about grief and grief in the change process and grief in transformation and grief in movements. And she says, I've learned the hard one lesson that grief demands its due and will take by force what is not freely given, which I found so powerful. And like thinking about how we do or do not surrender to grief, and how oftentimes we resist grieving because we're scared of that we'll lose control, or that we'll lose everything we know to be true, or that people won't understand us. And so what you're speaking to of like, one, just like connecting to your culture and practicing grief, experiencing grief in ways that maybe I'm assuming didn't feel as accessible to you previous to that, and how powerful that is. And then my question for you is, what have been some of the things that grief has demanded of you? It sounds like being able to physically change your appearance, like in the sense of cutting your hair or screaming, like that's one thing that grief demands you to do. Is there anything else that you would like to name in terms of how grief has found home in you or visited you or asked you to express itself?
For me, grief has demanded so much, and I have denied it for a very long time. I denied my own grief and felt in the quiets of my own. But when I started to ensure that the expression of that grief manifests, it meant that my hair has remained so short. And as like a trans woman, that in itself is is another thing. And Therese Malhot wrote an essay about her mother and her mother's grief. And the line was, "My mother's hair has always remained short." And that was something that stuck with me, and how the demand of this grief, and how it seems like every other month I'm burying someone in my community, and my hair keeps on getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And it feels so hard because so many folks just don't see that. And it's hard because it's such a physical manifestation of the way that my grief is held and processed. But there is one thing that my grief has also demanded of me, and it's the insurance of joy. And that despite any of that pain, that I am not engulfed in just one feeling, and that I am to feel and pursue joy when I can and at any opportunity. One of my mentors, he was very insistent that the way that grief and trauma rest in our body demands expression. And so he was always like, let's just dance. We're going to dance, and we're going to dance, and we're going to dance, and we're going to dance. And that is a demand. And I think that's something that is so beautiful, because there are so many different cultures where there's a mourning ritual, and a part of that is a dance and a feast and a process. And I think that's some ways that have manifested, but then also action. I cannot just like sit idly by when things are going on, and I don't ever want that to be something that everyone has to do. I don't think everyone has to be moved to do some sort of action or protest or anything like that, because I don't think it's sustainable and I don't think it's accessible. But there are so many ways in which my grief demands of me, and I am responsible to processing those feelings.
I'm imagining that grief, especially when we're young, when we don't have support, when we're experiencing it in isolation, when we're experiencing it without the support of culture and elders and all of those things, it can just be so heavy. We can feel like we're totally drowning, like it's the most horrible thing one can imagine. And so I'm guessing that it might have been, as you had some of these experiences, as you found some of these supports and found that grief can also demand joy, or it can also make space for celebration and dancing and love and things like that. That might have been a really big surprise. And I'm wondering what other kinds of surprises you've experienced through grief or because of grief.
One of the big surprises in it is that, like, as a youth, I felt so alone in it, and I just felt like it was just an experience on my own, and it was only ever mine. But one of the surprises I came across as an adult was that I wasn't alone. And from time to time, there were opportunities where I got to express that grief with other folks. And at first, some of that expression wasn't exceptionally healthy because of attachment styles, and it felt more like trauma bonding. But as I grew into expressing it and processing it, one of the things that really surprised me is that grief gave me new language and new understanding of old language, and also the understanding that we all process things differently. There are some times where I get information or news and I just start laughing, because it's the only thing my body knows how to do. And sometimes it's the grieving of a relationship ending, and I just burst out laughing. I was howling, and the person was so surprised, but that's just how it happens. And I think it's so weird. It's just so weird.
I'm really curious. I feel like as I get older, let me not project, but let me ask the question. As we get older, we oftentimes feel like there are parts of us that have to kind of stay where they are in order for us to become the person that we want to be. And there's parts of ourselves that we, you know, have to say goodbye to, or that we lose or we shed along the way, because oftentimes on the other side of grief is the change, and the change that we actually deeply want in our lives. And so I'm curious if you can name any of those parts that you've had to sort of put aside or say goodbye to, or be like, okay, cutie, you're going to just be here and I'm going to keep on going on this journey, you know, like what those parts were. Or...
A big one for me was I had to stop mourning my girlhood in my childhood. I always knew this is who I wanted to be. And it was denied for so long and actively persecuted. And one of the things I found myself doing was interrupting my adult self and my adult joy and my adult womanhood by clinging to this embittered loss. And, you know, I've been very, very, very blessed this year to, and in a little bit of last year, to inadvertently experience some of healing that inner girl. But I wasn't active in it because I found myself interrupting myself by being so angry about not getting these experiences. And I put that aside. I put that one aside because it wasn't healthy for me and it wasn't letting me move. It wasn't letting me grow. And so when I put it aside and I was like, I'm going to focus on me and I'm going to focus on me in 6 months. I'm going to focus on me in a year. I'm going to plant seeds for things that will come to fruition in 2 years and 5 years and 10 years. And when I started doing that is when things began to move. And whenever I wanted to fall into that rut again, I was just like, let me turn this into something to drive me.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about that transformation that you just described. And yeah, what I'm really sitting with right now is the ways that often we want to put aside our grief, like we want to let go of something that we're grieving when we're not ready. And I'm wondering for you how you've been able to maybe feel into the difference between I'm sick of this grief and I just want to avoid it and I just want to push it away versus what you just described, which was realizing this is something that I need to leave behind. And, you know, a very transformative process of putting something aside and creating something new or moving into a new place.
I think part of it is if we have this right support network, that's one thing that's really important in a conversation of isolation is when we see ourselves hurting, do we see it as a singularity? Do we see it as it just happening to us? Because that in itself is not true. And so I've been very, very honored to have such a beautiful support network where I may be going through something and my friends and my kin and my family will show up for me and hold me in ways that let me meet the very tangible needs that I have in that moment. They make sure that my fridge is full. They make sure that if anything, my house is tidy, that I get to go outside and have those moments. And then things don't just feel so dire. And I get to then make a decision on what I do with that. But then also my friends are very honest and they're like, you're really dragging that dead horse around. And it's holding you back. And it's something that I trust them. We've built that relationship and we've built that trust. And there are some times when I think about it myself and I'm like, am I holding this to move through it? Or am I holding this to not let go of it because there's a familiarity with that? And sometimes as like an act of self-soothing, I do keep things for longer than they need to be there because it's something I'm familiar with and comfortable with. But coming to terms with that over the past few years, I'm like, I don't want to be comfortable with hurt. I don't want to be comfortable with old hurt. I want to be uncomfortable in a way that lets me grow. And so that's what I've begun to do. And it's something where I've also let other folks know. I'm like, if you want to let go of it, you can let go of it. But like everything, healing is nonlinear. You can pick that up again if you want, you know, give it 3 months, if anything, like see where it goes. And then if it's something that is coming up and there's boundaries that are rising from it, then let's talk about that.
I'm so appreciating what sounds like this sense of spaciousness that you've been able to create in your relationship to grief. And it sounds like that relationship to grief has changed a lot over the years. I'm wondering if you can speak to, like, in almost a meta sense, like if you were to take a bird's eye view of your relationship to grief and how that's transformed, how would you describe it? How would you name it? And in particular, this idea of, you know, grief work. And I'm also going to quote once again Malika Devicheril, because she wrote that the goal of grief work is not to get rid of it, but to move closer and closer to it. And I'm wondering what that closer and closer means for you, because it sounds like it doesn't always mean, like you said, carrying the dead horse around. It sounds like there's some necessary distancing and picking it up and putting it down and having a different kind of relationship. And so, yeah, I just wonder if you could speak to that relationship that you have, or the relationship that you've cultivated over time with grief.
I would say, if we were to be cliche in a very interesting way, I would say it was like enemies to lovers. But not like, but more of a way where I was socialized to have such a disdain for it. And now it's an appreciation, because it's also like a very somatic response to it. And so it's a responsibility. It's a responsibility to move through it. And it's also like a responsibility of communication. It's like grief has really, really helped with my communication.
Tell us more. What does that mean for you?
I'm just more, it's helped me explore my capacity, my boundary, and not in a tender queer way, but in a like, hi, I actually can't do that right now because there are circumstances in my life that are keeping me from doing this. As much as I would love to do this, I will not be able to do this right now or in the foreseeable future. So here are a list of 5 other people who I think can actually do this for you according to your timeline. And some of it's in art, some of it's in consultation work, some of it's in just different fields and different aspects. But I refuse to move through my grief faster than I have to for the prospect of a project, unless there's like financial stuff going on. But then also at the same time, I have trust in my community and trust in my network that if I needed time and financial support, that that's something that could happen. But I now have such a strong comfort in my boundaries because of my processing and changing my relationship to grief. And also the pandemic, really, there was so much grief there and so many lost opportunities and chances that I went through. And I was like, it's over, it's done. Like I have a book coming out, but there's not going to be a book launch. There's not going to be a tour. There's going to be these things that I really wanted to experience. And at the end of the day, it changed some of the format, but it didn't change the entirety of it. And that took some time to realize and process and move through. And now it's completely shifted how I see my work as both like an artistic craft, but then also my work as like a community craft. Grief doesn't have to be such a negative thing. It's a healthy thing to feel. And it's something that you can decide to hold with gentle hands or tight hands. Like it's yours. It's something that you make of it, but you don't have to do it alone.
As you're talking about the ways that grief helped you to create different boundaries, helped you to communicate, like all of these gifts of grief, the way grief doesn't have to be a bad thing completely, it makes me think of our theme for this season on the podcast, which is transformative justice for self, which is looking at the ways we can change or transform the conditions within and around ourselves to allow for healing. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when it comes to grief, what grief has taught you about what you deserve, how you want to change the conditions within or around yourself to allow for your healing, or how grief has been a thing that has in itself transformed those conditions?
I think one of the things I think about a lot in regards to the transformation of my grief is when I was on my land and my territories with my own elders and my own teachers and being held by the root systems and the waters there. When I was going through a healing session, I kept on asking why. And I kept on saying like, why me? Why did this happen? Over and over and over again. And the elder stopped me And she was like, you will never, ever, ever get to ask these people why. And sometimes there was never a why. It was just because they did. And you need to stop asking why. And you need to just start saying what happened in a way that you can move through. And it revolutionized me, where it made me realize I will never get to ask my abusers why they abused me. I will never get to ask why these men took what they wanted. I will never get to ask why these women did what they did. And what I will get to do is say, in situations where I feel safe, that something bad happened and I should stop trying to exert all my energy asking why and exploring that avenue, and instead focus on the fact that that happened. And that was the focus. Like, have that conversation that happened, instead of saying why, and reprioritize your energy on acknowledging that it happened instead of trying to explore why. And when that happened, I got to let go of so much. I got to just, it just felt like it washed away. And then I was like, I'm going to say what happened in a way that's safe for me and hopefully safe for other people. And I feel like I've done that. And to me, that was, I think I wanted to ask why, because I wanted revenge. I wanted these people to admit that they'd done something wrong. I wanted these people to just know that what they did was evil. And my elder knew, and she was like, they probably don't have any remorse. They don't see that they did anything wrong. So why are you hoping that your hurt is so substantial enough that they can see the faults in their actions? That's impossible for some folks. Some folks are just, they just do it. And then she said, when you've done this healing and you can talk about what you want to talk about, you're going to grow in a way that feels so exponential. And I did. There is a radiance now. And it's because I'm no longer focusing on why people are doing shitty things, but more about the fact that it's like, okay, it happened. What can I do to interrupt it or stop it from happening to someone else? That is, if anything, something that grief has radically changed for me. But then also it has given me the lessons to help take care of other youth in care and other trans women. There is such a beauty to being able to have someone ask a question and I have the answer and I have the ability to take care of them. Or if I personally can't take care of them, I know people who can. And I think it's unfortunate that the things happened the way they happened. And I'm not saying they happened for a reason, because I think that's such a cruel ignorance of genocide. But I now have the tools necessary to provide the aftercare and also interrupt some of the actions. And I think I'm okay with that. I've made so much peace with that.
I'm just sitting with your words, and I think I will be for a long time. I'm just appreciating the expansiveness, the nuance, the depth. I feel like there's such a richness in the way that you talk about grief and all of the pain of it, as well as the lessons and the opportunities. And I'm just really grateful for that. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you.
Yeah. We are so lucky. We are so lucky to have you join us. We are so lucky to have you as somebody that we can call on that would be willing to have these conversations. And so, yeah, just so grateful for you and your time and your wisdom. And yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I think I would leave with saying that, like, there is a monstrousness I feel in myself. And I can say that grief didn't turn me into a monster. Man did. And I relish in the fact that my existence can be deemed such a perverseness to the colonial gears. And I think I want to leave with the fact that this work is not meant to be mine. It's meant to be cis folks. It's meant to be folks who enjoy our company but don't enjoy our livelihoods. And I think there's so much work to be done in, like, an abolitionist way and not in a reform way. And maybe that's a whole different conversation in a different way. It is. but also at the same time, let us be angry. Mm-hmm. Let us all just be so very angry.
Such a nourishing conversation with Jay. I don't even know what to say, but I'm so grateful that we were able to have them join us and talk with us.
Yeah, I couldn't have imagined that a conversation about grief could be so life-affirming and so empowering. It really blew me away. So what stood out to you from our conversation with Jay?
When Jay said that piece about you can, like, that grief is yours, that there's a possessiveness that we get to have in that relationship, and that you can pick it up and you can let it go and you can, you know, hold grief with like tight hands or gentle hands. I don't know, that really helped me better imagine my possibilities with how, when grief comes, how I want to be orienting myself to it and how I want it to be showing up as, you know, a companion for a time or some, a part of me for a time. And also what Jay said about the wisdom from one of her elders, like that the power is in acknowledging what's happened to you and validating what's happened to you rather than asking, why did this happen to me? That was so mind-blowing for me because I've been that person that's, you know, really focused on the why, the reason, the reasoning, the rationale, the fact that I wasn't deserving of something harmful coming my way, you know, and Jay saying that just made me think of all of the wasted energy and time that I've, you know, invested in that line of not even questioning, but in that just space of trying to make sense, as opposed to acknowledging and accepting and validating that it happened. And what did that, how does that make me feel? And what's been that experience for me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is the pain that comes from what is and what has been. And then there's all of the layers of suffering that get added on top when we're fighting against what is. And I think there's something about being able to just accept, you know, I didn't want this, but this is what happened. Mm-hmm. And being able to accept that and be in relationship with it and not fighting against it. I mean, it reminds me of a definition of forgiveness that I've heard, which is giving up the hope that the past could have been different than it was. Hmm. I think that was from Oprah. And it just, to me, was so powerful that there's this idea that it's not that you have to say it was okay.
Right.
But yeah, I think sometimes when you are asking why and so focused on this shouldn't have happened, it's like as if you're trying to change the past, which is always going to be a losing battle, and it can just drain you from all of your life force, your energy. So to be able to accept what is and just be with the pain of that, I think is very freeing.
Totally. And that reminds me of, I think, a quote by Shannon Perez Darby, who is a transformative justice mm-hmm. facilitator and educator. I believe this is from her, but that nothing will ever feel as good as the violence never happening to you. Like nothing will ever be as satisfying as a thing never having had happened. And when I remember when I came across that quote, I was like, why the fuck would we say this to people? Like, why would we give, what purpose does this have? But the closer I got to understanding the value of showing up for survivors, but and for all folks who have experienced harm, with this acceptance or this appreciation that we can't go back in time, but we can sit with what is, and like, let's talk about the impact of how that's showing up for you, and let's talk about how we can ease the suffering that's happening for you. that that's where there's power and that's where there's more spaciousness and that's where we can actually affect the change. Like that's where we need to be like living in. And so, yeah, those pieces, I wonder if that resonates for you as well, that like nothing will ever be as good as the violence never having had happened. And I'm also really curious of, as a therapist, like how that framing shows up in the therapy room, you know, like how do you support people in being able to sit in what is as opposed to what happened or what was or what we wish to have changed?
I think I really trust the process, and I think that there are times to be in the feeling that it wasn't fair and it shouldn't have happened, and why did this happen? I think sometimes we need to be there, and just fighting against that isn't actually going to help. And so sometimes for me, accepting what is that you might be in that place. Yeah. And that's okay. And I think being able to trust the process and just follow it step by step, to me, it's like there's going to be always different parts of us holding different things. There might be a part of us screaming, why did this happen to me? There might be a part of us that is able to, you know, have the clarity to accept it. There might be a part of us that says, I wouldn't have, you know, the depth of joy that I can experience, or, you know, the wisdom. I'm thinking about Nadine talking about in our last episode about how grief has been such a teacher for self-love for her. Mm-hmm. So all of those things can exist. And for me as a therapist, it's about letting each of those parts have their feelings without judgment, without mm-hmm. rushing them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I wonder if that resonates with you, just allowing these things to exist and not forcing, you know, even if we have these beautiful perspectives given to us by people like Jay, around how freeing it can be to let go of the why. Mm-hmm. But still maybe allowing the why to show up in moments if that's what is happening for you.
Mm-hmm. No, it really does resonate for me. And I think there has to be space for the unanswerable questions. Mm-hmm. Like there has to be room to put them on the table. And an acknowledgement that we might not be able to pick them back up again because they might not be serving us in a way, or they might be the question we come back to that remains unanswerable. And that's not indicative of the fact that we haven't healed enough or that we haven't gotten past it. It's that it's an unanswerable question. Like Jay said, like we'll never know the answer. And maybe some of us will, like maybe some of us do get the option to ask or receive the answer or whatever it might be. But that there's space for it, I think, is important, because otherwise I think so often we can turn that gaze back to ourselves as to like, why am I still asking this question? Which, you know, we've talked a lot about shame and like how that's just not a helpful framing for our ability to make sense of things. And I think also being able to put on the table, why did this happen to me, can also help us understand what the impact was, what we value, what we miss in our lives before the harm happened, what, you know, what we long for. Like, I think that it can be helpful. I just think that it can't be the only focus as we are wading through grief. I don't know if that resonates for you. How does that sound to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it really helps to get these different perspectives, to allow what arises to arise, but also to be able to find different ways of being in relationship with grief and different ways of moving through the process. On that note, I'm wondering if we could talk about something Jay was telling us about around how grief has been colonized and mm-hmm. sanitized, because I think maybe that colonization is part of why we don't have more of those really supportive rituals around grief and ways of understanding grief in a life-affirming way. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that connection between grief and colonization is really powerful because there's something deeply, I've experienced something deeply isolating being in grief and feeling like it's just mine to hold. And I think that without the communal sharing or holding space of grief, when we're not able to make it our collective issue or collective problem, it almost allows for that grief or the harm that we are grieving or the loss that we are grieving to be more acceptable. There's something that happens in isolation. And I think also just the sort of like sanitized way that I think we're oftentimes taught in our society and in our upbringing that like manifestations of grief have to look in a particular way. And they can't look like, for example, as Jay raised, like rage, right? Like cutting your hair, dancing, wailing, screaming until you can't scream anymore. Like those are such visceral manifestations of grief that make so much sense, because if we don't get to express that grief in that way, it gets lodged, it gets rooted in our bodies. And so I'm curious, I guess, you know, what have been manifestations of grief for you? Like how has that shown up, if at all? And then in your understanding, like how does grief affect our bodies? Like, do you have a sense as a therapist? I'm sure that there's something that you have to offer with respect to that. So like one's more personal and one's more sort of in your professional opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I relate to what you're saying about like the isolation of grief due to colonization. I think that our ancestors had ways of holding grief in community that allowed us to move through it in a different way, because grief is so big, you know, that holding it alone can feel crushing. But so many of us don't have connections with those practices anymore because of colonization. And yeah, I think a lot of times it has looked for me like an ongoing like heaviness and feeling of almost drowning or not being able to see outside of it because of having to hold it alone. And, you know, more recently it has looked like, yeah, more relational, being able to sort of allow feelings to arise. There's a lot of sort of living losses in my life, like living with chronic illness and the ways that that creates ongoing losses. There have been, you know, a couple of close family members that died in the last 10 years, you know, and it comes and goes. Like I think about them daily, but the waves come in different forms. And I think how it shows up in our bodies, it really depends on the support that we have or don't have and the practices that we have or don't have, because I think our bodies know how to heal. And even the most painful things, if we have containers for them and we have support, it can arise and it can fall away. And Jay talked about grief sometimes feeling good in a way, right? I think like it can, despite being painful, can be very rich and very life-affirming. But if we don't have those practices and that support to help us hold it, it can look like, as Jay talked about cortisol, it can look like stress, like ongoing stress that lives in our bodies that becomes sometimes physical pain or chronic illness or, you know, depression, anxiety, like a lot of experiences that, you know, instead of moving through us, it's getting stuck in us and it's manifesting in all kinds of pain.
I'm wondering, because Jay spoke
about sort of the gifts of grief, that it helped them with, you know, better communicating their boundaries and their capacity, for example, better appreciating and cultivating a practice of joy. What has grief given you? What have been the gifts of grief or the teachings of grief for you?
For one thing, grief has really connected me to the human experience in a particular way that feels very powerful. You know, it's understanding not only my own pain, but the pain that so many other people are in. And that allows me to connect with people, to understand people, to support people, and to be able to advocate for things to be different and for that grief to be held in different ways and honored in different ways. I also feel one of the most important teachings for me in my life, and it's something that I grapple with all of the time, it's that death is part of life.
Yeah.
And we in Western culture live in avoidance of death. Yeah. It's very pushed away. It is something that we try not to think about. We try not to talk about. We don't have a lot of rituals around. And we even pathologize grief. You know, like there's been, people are starting to diagnose, you know, if you're in grief for too long, it's like considered a mental illness. Like it's bizarre, honestly. And it's because of, in my opinion, the extreme avoidance of the reality of death and loss, mm-hmm. and how just integral it is in life. Mm-hmm. When you let that in, and when you live close to the knowledge that endings and loss and death are integral to life, it allows you to make different decisions. It allows you to make different decisions. It changes your values. It changes your idea of what is important. You know, What do I want to spend my time doing? How do I want to be in relationship? What are the choices I want to make in my life? You can't make those choices or really know what you value if you're not connected to the fact that everything that you currently have is going to end.
Yeah. Damn, I mean, a couple of people personally come to mind that I've had conversations with about just that, that grief has helped them sort of reorder their values and figure out like how they want to be spending their time. I would say for me, I completely agree with your point about how grief has supported you in being able to show up for others. I have found grief to be in the room when I'm doing my quote-unquote DEI work in particular. And I think that that's really fascinating. It's fascinated me, actually, that so often what we are in like corporate spaces, what we're trying to change is not the root. It's like, it's the expressions, it's the reactions, it's the exterior stuff, but what's at the heart of why we need to do any of this quote unquote diversity and inclusion work is because there's like tremendous amounts of harm. And that mm-hmm. means that there's tremendous amounts of suffering. Mm-hmm. And that means there's tremendous amounts of grief that people are wading through. And how grief manifests in a corporate professional setting is going to look really fucking different than the way it does in our day-to-day relationships with people that we love and we're with by choice, not because we have to be there. Grief has helped me be able to find the baseline humanity in the work that I do, which can so often be devoid of humanity, which is weird because that should be the focus always. Mm-hmm. And I think that when I've been in grief and been able to move through it, it's only deepened my connection with myself. It's only strengthened my vision of what it is that I want in life. And I really appreciated when Jay was describing how, you know, we asked the question, what have you had to put down? And she was like, mourning my girlhood. And the flip for her was like, now I'm trying to focus on who do I want to be in 6 months, in 12 months? Like, there's something about the futurity of it that's helpful in getting through the the current state. And that's been helpful for me as well. Mm-hmm. I think the last question that I have for you is, in your own healing process, what parts of you did you lose or have to put down or shed or let go of that were not serving you in moving through grief?
I think there have been a lot of coping tools that I've left behind. There has been a lot of ways that I learned to survive that ultimately were keeping me living in pain and suffering in a way that was unnecessary, that became unnecessary, I should say. But I think that I think of this a little bit differently, that I really strongly believe in not amputating parts. So there may be, again, tools, coping tools, survival strategies, ways of being that we want to leave behind. But I really believe in, first of all, honoring and offering gratitude towards those parts for the role they played in my survival. And also assuring those parts that while they may have outlived their usefulness to some extent, I may have different ways of being that I'm moving into, that these parts don't actually have to die or go away. It's sort of like, I'm asking you to please loosen your grip, and I'm going to, you know, be there to show you that you don't have to do this anymore. And there's other parts that are able to step forward to help us not only survive, but to flourish. But, you know, thank you for everything you've done, and you can still be here, and you can still, you know, maybe you still need me to visit you sometimes to like hear your pain. Or maybe there might be moments where your survival strategy comes in handy again. So it's like, you know, I just said that death is part of life, and I believe that. So it's not like I think there can't be deaths within us. But for me, I've just never found that I can choose to amputate or put down a part, because it feels so important to honor every part of myself. So I don't know if that's a contradiction. How does that land with you?
I think the contradiction is kind of the bigger picture of everything, right? That there's like that both we want to put it down and we want it to stop playing such a large role in our life, and it's taught us something. There's a lesson. There's a function of that part. And taking what you said previously about how we live in like a death averse culture, I think we also live in a like nuance averse, or like you know, culture where we're like, it has to be this or it has to be that. So I really appreciate you saying both that, you know, the death averse is not serving many of us, or being death averse is not serving many of us, and that also maybe it's an ideal, or it's sort of less realistic. And in reality, maybe it's an ideal or less realistic for us to actually amputate and sort of like, you know, the death of those parts of us that no longer serve us. And maybe what is more realistic and more manageable is quieting those voices, or quieting those parts, or tending to those parts in ways that are still affirming that they exist and that they might still be needed, and that's part of it too. I gotta say, it's been so lovely to unpack the conversations that we have with our guests together, so thank you.
I love that we're getting to add so much more nuance and complexity through these other perspectives, and I'm gonna be continuing to unpack these conversations within myself for a long time.